It is Friday, March 10th. This is the Data Protection Breakfast Club with our guest, our really good friend, Julia Shulman, brought to you by TechGC.
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 Yeah.
The best.
The best.
What a week. Here we are. What a week.
What's here, man?
Yeah, you doing okay?
Yeah, we're getting through it, man. I mean, you know, people can read the news. It's a tricky time for folks in large tech, and
totally.
Just trying to navigate it as best I can. I had my team offsite this week. They were all here in Atlanta. It's the first time since I joined the company we've all been in one place, which was really cool. And
that's so great that you got it to be in Atlanta. That's so fun.
Well, I'm the only person on the team who lives here. But what I did was I asked someone on my team to create a committee and plan the offsite. We did that late last year. And, you know, for locations, we just tossed every location where people on the team live. And Atlanta was one of them, obviously, because I'm here. And then they came back to me and said, we did the numbers. And based on the distances people need to travel and like the cost, Atlanta is the best place for the offsite. And I was like, well, shit. Sounds like y'all are coming to me. So that's how it actually played out. It's not like I said, you know, travel to Atlanta where I reside. It was more like they came back and said, we crunched the numbers on all the locations. And
that's like, so great.
Easiest place for everyone to get to is Atlanta. And, you know, also it was the cheapest way to do the offsite.
It's not surprising because Atlanta's airport is a hub for
best, man.
So much travel. So
yeah, it's
not
the
surprised.
Best airport. There's a
and
flight.
And it's a great city. And it's a fun place to
visit. Great city. And, you know, and like everything's sort of concentrated in one place. The cost is low. We have a really beautiful office here. It's small, but it's great. And, you know, I mean, there's like a flight from every major city in the country and most cities in the world every hour into Atlanta. So like,
did you like have people over? Did you get a chance to like entertain?
So interestingly, two people from my team landed at the same time while I was near the airport. So I picked them up and on the way back into the city, we stopped at my house and they met Keanu. So like,
nice. I bet.
Niece and Andrew.
That's a celebrity.
Yeah. They got to meet Keanu and come to the house. I got to tell you, having work people at your house that's a first for me. And it's weird. But yeah, I work with these folks every day. It's cool, but it's just strange having these.
During COVID, I did a lot of, when the weather was nice, I did a lot of, I have a back patio with table and an umbrella and it seats, you know, 8 people. And so I would have random team members from Alice come over and work, you know, on the patio. And now a bunch of us are at different companies and they want to continue it. So we still want to work together, which I think is really fun. So it was really nice. It was really nice to be able to have people, you know, at my house, just kind of relaxing. We would order, shout out to Adam Rivera, our buddy. We would order DoorDash all the time and we would just, you know, hang out and connect in between meetings. It's so valuable.
That's super cool. I'm sort of the opposite, man. I mean, I think I'm a people person, but while at work, I like to be alone. And, you know, I've been working remote in my house for there's almost 8 years, man. Like I've been remote a long time.
Yeah.
And so I'm all about the Zooms and the videos and the things and like, let's all get together and let's go meet in neutral places. But like, I feel like this is my bat cave where I do the job, you know?
Yeah. I'm definitely a remote work convert, you know, now that this is the situation that I'm in, I feel like I work a lot better and I can focus more.
I am so much more effective and can do so much more work when I'm by myself. Also, I have a strong personality. I don't think people like want to be in the same room with me all day. But I get so much done. My commute is 0 minutes. That means like I spend my commute time working. Okay. Like, you know, I have time to read. I have time to study. I have time to catch up. I have time to, you know, just do, right? Do like the point of, I think Meta pays me to do. And like me on my own, I do a lot. Me surrounded by people, there's more talking.
Yeah. It's just, you're right. It's that, what's the it's the balance you got to achieve. Yeah. Well, speaking of balance, one of the most effective and balanced GCs I know is our friend Julia. Three-time appearance. what a celebrity.
This is a, that makes her the world champion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, now that she's one of the greats, for sure.
She is one of the greats, man. She's one of the greats.
I'm excited for people to hear it. She's got a lot to talk about. She's off doing her own kind of two or three different projects now, and excited for her and what she's building.
She's a beast, man. It was a good convo. I'm excited to share it.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I just spent 27 minutes trying to figure out how to get my camera to work, which I use 750 times a day, but today decided it didn't want to turn on. Like, what is that about, man?
Well, we're
can
here.
Can we talk about how far, can we talk for 1 second about how far MacBooks have fallen? I remember, I've been a MacBook guy for a long time, and I remember you'd press on that little sucker, it'd make the little Apple sound, the Apple would show, and boom, log in and you're good. It took my thing 4 minutes to boot just now. What is that about?
What are you running?
Dude, I run Chrome. Like... Okay, this is what I do. I run Google Docs on Chrome.
Running in the background. Just, you know.
I don't have anything going on here, man. I've got Chrome running on my computer. That's literally it.
I hear you're running a real-time bidding platform from your laptop.
I'm not from a MacBook Pro in my basement. No, I'm not.
Well, if you're one of the topics testers, they're building an audience in your browser.
One of the main nodes of the Fediverse is my MacBook Pro. This is really what's happening.
All right. Well, what an in bump. What a lead in here. Here we are with Julia Shulman. Yeah. One of our best friends in privacy. It's good to be here.
Are we best friends forever? Is that how we call it? Are we best, like super best friends forever?
BFFFS?
Yeah, I think we are. We should go to IAPP's Global Summit this year and like pass notes during the panels, like true best friends.
We should have like when we do stickers, I can do a version of a privacy BFF sticker instead of the past we've done like, yeah.
Maybe like a best friend necklace, right? Where it's sort of...
We have best friend necklaces. I really want us to have this.
Andy, you've got some design challenges ahead of you.
Maybe the necklace is actually a SHA-1 hash of best friends, you know?
I think this is the way, man. I think this is the way. Did you see what's-his-name is making a Bob Ross-based movie? What's his face? Big nose guy from Wedding
Owen
Crab.
Wilson.
Yeah, Owen Wilson. Yeah.
Yeah, for those that don't know, we have a little subgroup called Privacy Painters where we discuss a lot of issues on chatting on Signal and sometimes in person, and the symbol created by Pedro is Bob Ross.
Bob Ross is our, he's our man.
You're painting happy trees and I have my happy tree.
There it is.
That's for you.
I really like that you have a holiday wreath and what looks like a Christmas pine tree back there, but they're not very decorative. They're not decorated. They're just there.
I'm sorry. It's there, number one, because I haven't been out at my house in like 2 months. And number two, because I need to get something fixed. I also think I maybe have, you guys are going to watch my oil get filled in the
house. I was literally going to say, I see a man dressed in all black walking around your yard with a large rope, and I'm really nervous, but okay, it sounds like
she has no privacy right now.
I'm in a fishbowl. I assumed that my Zoom background with the blur would come on, but that's not the case.
No, I like
it. Welcome to my living room, everyone.
Very nice. All right. Very, very nice.
Let's do it by way of background, for we know you really well, obviously, but by way of background, this is Julia. You were, when we met, I think running commercial at AppNexus as well as privacy, or just commercial. And then AppNexus sold to AT&T, kind of converted to Xandr, the kind of TV platform, and then you were GC and CPO at Triplelift, another ad tech company. Now you're on your own with a company and an advisory. But what was the first job at AppNexus that you did?
So I was brought in to run commercial and product for the publisher technology group, so the publisher side of the business. We had the advertiser side and the publisher side. And the publisher side, while I was running that, we launched the AppNexus ad server. We launched header bidding, which is, if anyone who's read the Google complaint realizes that sort of upended the auction dynamics in the ad space. We did 4 acquisitions, YieldX, OpenAdStream, AdServer, number of different things. So it was
Did commercial encompass M&A? So you kind of helped on the buy side or no? Was that somebody else?
It encompassed the integration piece of M&A. So I was an M&A lawyer for years and kind of at that time was actually pretty happy to not be like running point on the entire negotiation piece. That was really Nithya and another colleague of mine. But because they were heavy commercial and tech deals, we would get involved, me or my colleague on my team would get involved in understanding the business, thinking through how we were going to technically integrate the product or the tech that we were doing and then the commercial piece. And we actually had a number of different flavors. You know, we bought a few companies that we ran separate for a bit. We bought a company that where we integrated the technology and closed the entire commercial business side of it down. And then we bought, you know, another company that.
I have a question about that. Integrated. I have a question about that.
Yeah.
When you did that, as a startup that scales and grows, and then you go buy companies. I have a certain set of experiences around that too, but I think I'm wondering, like, when you do that, do people have proficiency in integration of companies? Because that's actually really hard from a tech cultural perspective. How did y'all think about that? Because, and I also want to hear about from Pedro's time, like specifically at Oracle and Salesforce, because they're so acquisitive, like how they thought about that. But did you have that talent in-house or how did you learn that to do that?
So 2 things. Like first, before I was at AppNexus, I had worked as an M&A attorney in-house at a very acquisitive company. United Business Media was a media and events company. So I had done that for about 3 years before going to AppNexus. But no, I mean, no one has a proficiency at that until, you know, you kind of like are in the middle of it and you appreciate both the people side of it, the business side of it, and then the like everything else, which is a mix of, you know, what your thesis is around the business that you're building, you're buying, and how you're planning on integrating it and running it go forward. And that goes back to my, like, are you going to integrate the technology and deprecate the commercial side of it, or you're planning on running it separately, or are you planning on integrating both the commercial and the tech side and really just based on personalities at the table and your timelines, are you going to kind of rip the bandaid off and throw everyone together right off the bat, or are there stages to it? And we did that mostly all in-house because I think you need to be part of the business to really create those relationships and think through the process, timeline, and challenges that you're going to face. But Pedro, curious to hear your thoughts, as Andy said.
Well, considering the fact that my computer froze during about 10% of that, and then I lost you guys, what was the question, Andy?
We were curious about, Oracle, very acquisitive company. When you go do that kind of work, they looked at integration a different way than I think kind of when we were talking about AppNexus. It's hard to figure out what your plan is going to be to integrate a company, whether it's tech, whether it's people. So I was wondering, like, you saw a pretty well-oiled machine at Oracle. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, look, Oracle knows how to acquire companies, but I think like the purpose for acquisition really matters on how the integration works, right? Because sometimes they're not trying to buy a company. They're trying to buy, IP, or they're trying to buy an engineering team. It's, it just sort of depends on what the purpose of the acquisition is, the frame from which you approach the integration, right? And so if it's an issue of like, we want to buy an entire business and all of its people and integrate it into Oracle, I think there's like 2 ways. Either is this going to be a feature on one of our existing products or a function or a component of one of our existing products, or is it going to be complementary to those? And like the level of independence, I think that the acquired company gets sort of depends on those factors. So like there's no one way to do it. I do think sometimes when the IP is like, I wasn't part of this integration for very long, but when Salesforce bought Tableau, I don't know that there was like, I don't know that the integration has gone the way that Salesforce planned it to when they bought Tableau. Like, I think Tableau has sort of become very much a feature versus a standalone product into like Salesforce's suite of things, right? Whereas if you look at Slack, people don't even, 2 years later, people don't really associate Salesforce with Slack that heavily. And it's because Slack sort of just continues to operate. There's much more integration between Salesforce products and Slack, but Slack is still Slack. And like, you don't have to buy CRM to use it, right? And so like, honestly, Andy, that's a long way of saying that really depends on what the business goals are when the acquisition happens. And then it also depends on how that integration starts to flow and sort of like the signal that comes out of that, whether like there needs to be a pivot toward just complete dissolution and integration into products or to just build a new business, right?
Or spin it off again in the case of
Outnext. Or spin it off again.
Right?
We HP were, and Yahoo we were, can teach a lot of it. Yeah.
Right? As part of the Warner strategy, and now look at that. Right.
Will you break down what happened for people? Because I think the players are not, if you're not in it, you don't know it.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, AppNexus was a standalone ad tech platform, mostly full stack SSP, ad server, DSP, a bit of a DMP. And in connection with AT&T's very public acquisition of Warner Media back in 2018, after it went through, you know, litigation, AppNexus was bought as part of the strategy to power their media and ads strategy that has obviously not played out the way that they had planned on it. And so when AT&T spun out Warner, they also then sold AppNexus Xandr to Microsoft. And it's now a big piece of Microsoft's strategy around not just their ad business, but I would presume their gaming, their cloud. You know, it is a pure full stack if you compare their assets to Google.
It's been really nice to see some of the ad tech companies that we came up with, even with the dynamics of spinoffs and such. In each of those cases, the technology was really important. And in my case, working at DataXu, which was acquired by Roku, that technology is still really important to what Roku's doing. And I think we all the alumni, have pride in that.
Yeah. I mean, the technology and the know-how. Right. Think about the know-how that all of your former ad tech colleagues from DataXu brought into Roku, or you know, from my perspective, the know-how that sat within kind of the AppNexus alums, what they brought to Xandr, Warner, AT&T, and now over to the Microsoft team. They had their own ads business, but it brings a more programmatic and holistic view into that strategy.
Definitely does. What, when did you know it was time to go to Triplelift?
To Triplelift? When a couple months after we were acquired by AT&T, and we were all very, very excited about their data strategy and saw that it looked great on paper, I realized that, you know, being part of a larger organization, you were going to get a bit more pigeonholed. And that's natural. It's a big legal team. You know, it's a big business. And you can't have a bunch of people who are utility players working across, you know, different functions and even just different skill sets within the legal team. So I was getting pushed down a route to either pick public policy, privacy, you know, or more of a commercial and product role. And I didn't want that. I like to be in the weeds, building new things and able to not only work across different legal functions, but also work across different functions, whether that's privacy, management team, you name it. So I started looking for, you know, a new role. You and I talked a lot about it. I didn't know whether I wanted to be a GC, whether I wanted to be a CPO, whether I actually wanted to go down more of a policy and product route, and whether I wanted to stay in ads or actually leave the ad space entirely. And I talked to a lot of different companies and ultimately decided that if I was going to take on a GC role, I wanted to do that in an industry that I knew where I had relationships. And so I'd be coming into a company doing that as my first GC role, but at least for a company and in a space that I knew incredibly well and where I could have a strategic impact on the business, not just as a lawyer, but as someone who was a privacy expert and could help them think through their long-term business strategy around privacy.
Were they receptive to that? Like, I feel like in our Signal chat, there's some chatter recently about some folks feeling burned out by management teams that don't really get the strategic value of legal. And did they get that from the get-go?
So I was, Eric recruited me in because he had known about what I'd done with you all and, the rest of our industry crew on the privacy front. So I came in certainly with, a leg up because he didn't just recruit me as a lawyer. He recruited me as someone he thought could come in and help them navigate, not just defensively, but offensively, the changes coming in privacy and identity. And that's not from a regulatory perspective. Of course, that's a big deal. But Apple, Google, what all the gatekeepers were doing and what we needed to structurally ensure we were taking advantage of that and ensuring we could make it through. So it wasn't as hard for me to kind of help drive a narrative at the company that the legal team and the privacy team were not just there to kind of play defense on compliance issues, but we were really there as true business partners and thought leaders and actually owned, parts of our go-to-market strategy around privacy and identity. But that's certainly not something that legal teams naturally have at companies. And so whenever I'm looking at opportunities, I think you said this too, I'm always looking to go to a company where my skill set is not just needed as a lawyer, but also helps with the business's strategy.
Yeah.
You're seeing that. I mean, that's why you joined OpenAP, I would presume.
It's a big deal. Yeah. I think a big part of it was when I met with Dave, the CEO, and we talked about the relationships with the company's ownership. It's owned by large TV networks, and those lawyers and privacy teams, we need a connective tissue there. And so I think that's something that I personally feel like I can try to bring. And that comes with strategy. You can't do that without a strategic angle. Less legal, more got to know the legal and got to know the privacy, but more strategic as well. Mm-hmm. But Pedro, that's got to be part of your life too, and policy now, I imagine.
But yeah, I think the difference is that finding, you talk about connective tissue when you're in an enterprise that's as big as mine. The connectivity between those tissues tends to be longer distances, right? And so you really have to work at building a broad suite of relationships within the company. There's almost no day that goes by that I don't talk to someone new, just someone new who's been here just as long as me or longer. And for whatever reason, we're connecting that day for the first time in a meeting or in a chat thread or on an email string, or whatever it is. And the fact that 2.5 years in, that's still happening just goes to the scope and breadth and size of the company. But it's not new for me at Meta. That's how it was at Salesforce. That's how it was at Oracle, which is the biggest corporation I've ever worked at, right? And so just embracing sort of the, I don't know what the word is, but the beginner's mindset of relationships and just approaching them all that way has helped me be able to increase the scope and scale of my individual impact at my teams. Does that make sense?
It does. My follow-up would be how do you get to strategy then? Meaning not how, but how do you do that within the context of a brand new relationship, really large company, remote work? It's a different world. We have to be so intentional about the relationships that we form. And then strategy is the next level. I don't really want to go to a strategy conversation until I kind of have a sense for somebody and whether we're going to vibe on that or not. How do you do that?
Yeah, I honestly, man, I worry less about the vibes. And I'm very direct, as you guys know. That can be off-putting and that's fine. But if I don't know you and I have to get to a decision in 30 minutes, I just don't have the luxury of water coolery stuff. So I'm very direct. Hey, I'm Pedro. I work here. This is what I do. Here's the decision that I'm working towards, or here's the threat that I'm addressing. I need your help. And we just go from there. Okay. Or the alternative, which is, hi, I'm Pedro. I hear you're working towards XYZ. How can I help? Like, as soon, like, in like those two types of intros, I think are pretty strong. Does it come on strong sometimes for different personalities, for some types of personality? Sure. But like, I just don't have the luxury, man. And I don't have that high expectations on my end either. Like, I don't need people to finesse me either.
Yeah. Second one, by the way, is massive. Yeah. Like, through my entire career. Like, the coffee, what's the biggest thing you're working on? Can I help?
Yeah, like, how can I help you? It's like a really good icebreaker. Okay. Like, you know, what can I do to help really, you know, lowers the defenses, right? Which I think is
so. I have a related question for Julia. So you are in a house that you've done a lot of renovation work on. So I was so curious about, like, has doing a big renovation changed your thinking at all about large, messy projects? Because that's like our day to day anyway. But did it give you any like outlook shift? Because I've done it and I have thought about it a little bit.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Here's two things I thought about on that one is, one, it actually frankly gave me an appreciation for the professionals that we've worked with in our career and the companies we've been at, even if they don't necessarily know how to do a big cross-functional project. You're working with people who most of the time are like sitting in front of their computers and are pretty used to being quick and fast on the uptake versus, and this is no knock on contractors or people working on a house, like you're in a physical house, like you're doing work and you're on your phone and you're trying to read messages that people are sending you via text or email and you have zero time. So I had a bit of an appreciation, frankly, for the messy projects I've worked on and how easy I think they were compared to managing home projects. But the other flip side of that is bringing skill sets and learnings that we've all developed over the years to managing this project. So I very quickly was able to see from my contractors and the folks working on stuff, see things from their point of view and adapt to how to communicate with them, adapt to how to keep them on track, adapt to having certain milestones, building in buffers, being very, very direct. And, you know, figuring out how to kind of get them to react and react well and get things done in a positive and harmonious way, as opposed to kind of clashing and having a challenging relationship from there. What about you? Curious.
Let's see. I think until you have gone through a really complicated plumbing project, I think there's not really an understanding of how intense the work of a plumber is. Like, I could never do that job. Like, it's a skill set I can't even imagine knowing how to do. Like, and so I don't say that, you know, in any way to sort of like, I don't know, like, oh, you know, I'm not saying like, oh, you know, like people think one thing about plumbers, but, you know, no, like, it's just, if you don't know or understand the project, then you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And when you see the pipes and the way the intricate pipes have to flow up through a home, it's just like anyone that says that that's, you know, a job that is easier than anyone else's job is insane. Right. They're insane. Yeah. Right. It's an insane statement. So I think I learned certainly, like, you know, the level of complexity in every job is pretty high. And I think that's still, that means like, and that means that translated to trust them, unless they're like out to screw you. And that's a separate potential. And I think, you know, in this case, nobody was, but, yeah, I think I learned to trust the experts.
A great takeaway.
Plumbing is hard. It's harder than being a privacy professional. I'll leave it. I'm 100% positive, and the stakes are really high. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Plumbers, shout out to plumbers.
We had on Christmas Day a flooding basement. Oh, the entire basement was filled with water. I'm talking 6 inches of water.
Oh.
And it kept coming. It was just pouring rain. And finally, I was able to find someone to help me. And it was an outdoor problem that had to be like fixed. Oh, and it was, you know, it was very difficult. And I had to have two different people come out. One person couldn't figure it out. And the water kept rising. You know, and so to your point, Pedro, it's like the stakes are high. Like things are getting ruined. You know, like your house is getting damaged, you know, as it's happening. And someone came in and saved the day. And I basically was like, I wanted to like hug this person. Oh. You know, like it's Christmas Day. And I spent all night, you know, with a water vac getting this stuff out of. And so it's a lesson. It's a true lesson. Like, trust the experts. They know what they're doing.
But I think it's also okay to challenge prevailing ideas, right? Like in our world, look, I'm not going to challenge a plumber's prevailing ideas because I don't have the angle. But if you're an expert, your relationship with other experts is different, right? And it doesn't. I don't think it's a no trust environment, but I also think like there's a lot of deference to pre-established norms in our profession, which I think is actually inhibiting creativity. I posted about this on LinkedIn, sort of like subtly, but you know, there's like falling in love with plans and ideas happens a lot in our industry, right? And like once you're in love, you're not seeing clearly. And so I try not to romanticize concepts at work because you tend to stop thinking creatively when you do that. And so I, as antagonistic as this sounds, like creating the environment for disagreement, I think not disruption, not dispute, but disagreement is really healthy, even though it makes some folks uncomfortable. In our work.
Yeah. And I have to assume, so at smaller startups, you just tend to have that, right? Like everyone likes to debate and chat through things. And then at larger companies, it can certainly derail and slow things down. And so at some point people just, you know, have to move forward and they don't want to have people throwing additional wrenches into conversations or projects. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think the larger the organization, the more like operational inertia starts to be a force of decision-making influence. And pushing back on that is literally my life's work because like there are some benefits to like the normalcy of tried and true routines and like avenues of approach. But if you as an organization or even a group within a large organization, like a legal team, want to be at the cutting edge of whatever it is your area of responsibility is, you cannot do that through spreadsheets and swim lanes and like corporate norms. Like there has to be an environment of just like hostility to stability. And that is not for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, I've seen it done a number of different ways on the privacy side, but what I've found work is, you know, some new change happens. You look at what one of the gatekeepers are doing, a new regulation, and people want to know, okay, like what's the plan? What's going on and what is your recommendation on what to do going forward? So what I've learned to do is put that in front of people, but also keep an open dialogue and open meetings that don't waste too much time on market norms, the conversation, what's shifting, because it's never going to, like, you're never going to have a change that everyone knows exactly what's going to happen, you know, in the next year or two. And there's a perfect plan that you're just going to follow. And that's it. It's just like another product feature. You have a plan. And then there are many other pieces on the chessboard or on the billiards table that are moving. And as soon as one of them shifts, something else shifts. So you need to continue the conversation and continue to follow what's happening and potential opportunities to pivot very, very quickly if you need to.
So on that point of pivoting, like do you think that startups and smaller tech companies are just more comfortable with the idea that we're going to iterate on things and bigger companies aren't? Because like to your point, Pedro, even in big companies that I've been in, you do make a decision at some point and you go and you have to make a decision and you go and you know the decision is made and people have to work from there. But is that it? Is it a lack of comfort with the pivot?
I don't know if it's a lack of comfort as much as it's just a bigger shift to shift. And startups or companies that are, you know, earlier in their life cycle are just very used to that struggle of finding product market fit and constantly having to stay on top of things. And so they're not, they don't have these large cycles. They're just constantly flowing in market feedback, customer feedback, their own feedback. It's part of that standard loop. And the privacy side, it can be challenging because it's not necessarily product market feedback as much as just keeping your ear to the ground and understanding where everything's going. But that's what I've seen at smaller companies versus larger companies. There's also the other thing that I've seen is, especially at senior levels, at larger companies, people just, they want complete confidence in like, here's the recommendation and here's what we should be doing. And they don't want to indicate to management that there could be a disconnect or, you know, there could be some quite open questions or issues. And I'm always one to say, hey, look, here's the plan, but like, you should know there's these five things still going on. And to the extent something shifts, we're going to need to shift this. It's just having that confidence to actually say, this is not a slam dunk, but we think this is the best avenue right now.
But here's where I agree. Here's where I think big organizations sort of lose traction a little bit or become inert. When large groups, when large groups of people that are really smart get together to make recommendations, here's what generally happens. Andy's got a great idea. He puts it out there. Julia's got another great idea. She puts it out there. Pedro's got a decent idea. He puts it out there. We start debating our idea. We start to work towards some sort of compromise between the three ideas, and we send that up for approval, review, whatever. And so, like, I actually don't think that's a way to be innovative, right? Because you end up with, like three levels down of each of our ideas, right? So if Andy, so I think the better way, and something me and Rob, who's my manager, and some folks around the company have been talking about recently is, what's a better way to do this? Like, if Andy has a really great idea, the question is, what is it optimizing for? Like, is it optimizing for revenue? Is it optimizing for growth? Is it optimizing for compliance? What does Andy's idea pivot around? And leave his idea intact and just frame it as, idea A is optimized for revenue growth. Julia, on the other hand, idea B is optimized for, compliance. Hey, leaders, what do you want to optimize for? Growth or compliance? These are the options, right? And then take the risk on one or the other. The compliance one means less revenue. The revenue growth one means a riskier compliance strategy. But you actually get to make business decisions based on what's being optimized for versus making business decision based on every smart person you've hired to tell you what to do, watering down their idea. That to me is really risky for companies.
It's a nice idea. It's a nice idea. I think the only kind of finer point I would put on it is, and this may be a difference between big and small companies too in some ways, but is that from where I sit, I do think you need to give a point of view. Especially lawyers and policy folks, like between these two ideas that are both good and optimizing for X or Y, my thought process is that maybe X edges out Y because of these market reasons or something. You know, obviously everyone's going to get to weigh in, but my point of view is this. I think that's helpful.
Yeah, but I think like legal is always going to say ours optimizes for legal compliance, right?
Like, I don't know. Hopefully not.
No, I will push back on that one because I do think lawyers, at least from the school of thought that I come from, have to know the product and services better than, frankly, many of the folks that are working on those products and services. And so if you are able to understand those products and services as well, if not better than everyone else, you understand the market, you understand what everyone's doing, and you understand real risks, you can actually be even more aggressive in the business because they might just be reading what's in the paper and not fully appreciating that big picture, which is the way that I'm
operating. It's a good point.
But lawyers, I agree. Like, and we're all lawyers. Like, lawyers in corporations that sell things need to know the products through and through. But our lens through which we view and understand the product is through legal risk management. Like, I'm not looking at the product through a growth strategy for like adoption. That if I am, I'm actually wrong, because my job is to go in and find all the problems or all the risks that are involved with the product. That's what like the company's paying me for, not to figure out how to create the new button that's going to, you know, increase adoption by 500%. So like, I think just the lens through which lawyers view and begin to understand their worldview on products is just different and not well designed or suited for optimizing it for non-legal risk issues. To your point, though, can we help unlock things because we look at things through one lens or another? Sure, but I don't think that's the usual approach that like product counsels take. That's not what I see. That's just not.
Yeah, I think it depends. If it's a smaller company and you've got a really good grasp on everything and you need to look at it from kind of every single lens and you're not just fully inundated, to your point, on looking at it through a legal lens, I actually do think you might be in a privileged spot to be even more aggressive and see even more opportunity because you understand that the risk is low or you understand what the rest of the competitive landscape is doing. And that's, you know, very specific.
I think it's a good call out. I think Pedro, you're both right. I think in bigger companies, lots of product counsel functions do work that way, and they work within that lens. And then I think also the best product counseling that I've ever done is when I'm in a room with the team that's developing a feature, and the things that I'm able to say help either move it faster, make it better, and our risk coverage. You know, take care of risk coverage, because obviously you're right, Pedro. Like, I am coming at it from like, what's the data? What are we using? What are we doing it for? But like, if I know your goal in mind, and this is related to what you said with the two ideas, if I know that this idea, this feature optimizes for, you know, revenue or compliance that will drive revenue or something, I know what that is. I have that in my mind, and my product counseling advice can be geared towards that thing, I think. And so I do think like that's where I felt like I've actually added the most value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you can help them avoid some costly build or costly back-end technical build that's true. Not necessary, because you have a better sense of the market and what they're doing because that team is working on 8 million other things. But Patrick, you know, you're right. For the most part,
that we're all right. I mean, I think the point Andy makes is correct, which is it's very circumstance-based, right? Like, where a corporation organization is in its life cycle sort of depends like how heavily things lean into like audacity, which I mean, audacity is a good thing, like just being audacious and being bold and taking big risks. And, you know, when you get bigger, you got shareholders, you got the SEC, you got whoever, FTC, whatever, looking at you and scrutinizing you. Like, there's just less room. There's less.
Yeah.
The process is less suited for audacious action. And that's why you see very few large corporations inventing new things. They buy them, but they don't invent them. And the reason for that is because there's all these mesh mechanisms around them that stop them from doing that. Like Mercedes-Benz invented the car, right? What if they invented sense? That is a gigantic shift for Earth, right? Like, they clearly knew how, and I don't think that they have less talented people. I think the organization is just not designed for that at this time.
I love that phrase, audacious action. I mean, I actually think that describes Julia's career in a lot of ways. Like, and well, just, I mean, you know, being willing to put a point of view out there and being willing to get really technical and being willing to like take risk if it's thoughtful and you've you know, done the kind of the work behind the risk.
Also, like, I think
you guys know.
Go ahead, Julie.
No, I was just going to say, you guys know me. I like kind of getting in there and rolling up my sleeves, understanding your goals, understanding what's going on, and understanding the potential opportunities that are there. And I think many of us actually operate more like product managers than lawyers. It's really marrying the two.
Yeah, and like, by the way, when you are a big organization and you try to do something bold, it is really, that in and of itself is just risky, right? Like, look at my company and the metaverse, right? That's a pretty bold vision for something new. Like, you know, Mark came out a year and a half ago, renamed the entire company, and said, we're going to pivot to build this new way of interacting with each other and this new space for like humankind. And look at the stock price. Look at the critiques from Wall Street. What Meta is losing money. We're not losing money. We're investing money in creating new things. Like that's what we're doing. And we have the resources to do it. Right. And so we're trying to explore spaces that go unexplored by companies that have the resources to explore them because they're afraid. And one of the things that's sticky to me about this company, I think we're going to be successful on the metaverse stuff. It might look like something different than what we think it will, but I think we're going to be successful. But even if we weren't, even if 10 years from now, someone looked back and said, that was a mistake, man, I'm fucking glad I worked at the place with the guts to just go for it. Like, I just don't see that by big corporations very much. And so like,
I mean, it's really hard when you've got public shareholders and a lot of pressure. Yeah. And to your point, you've got a, you know, big business that is already throwing off a whole bunch of revenue and already under siege from a number of different actors versus a small private company that has nothing to lose, right? They've got everything to lose if they don't go out and they don't innovate and they don't continue to shift and meet the market.
Yeah.
It's a great discussion. Well, hey, one last thing I want to touch on was one of the things we know about you as your friend is that you are really, really intentional about taking time off. You work really hard, but when you're off, you're off. And I've always like really respected that about you. Like I fight with this internally, you know, a lot for myself. Pedro, you've been doing a lot more of this for yourself too. Like,
yeah. And I also curse you out when you like ping me from vacation and tell you to go away.
I know it helps. I mean, you're like, honestly, like it sounds silly, but that's a good friendship move, you know, by you to do that. Like, stop doing this and, you know, go do whatever else you
should be
doing.
I don't want to hear from you at that time. I don't want to hear from you at the beach. Go away.
The problem is, I have ideas, and honestly, half the time I'm dropping them in somewhere so I don't forget them. But that's not a good excuse, right?
Yeah.
Not a good excuse. So how do you do it, Julia? You're like, make sure you're going on vacation. You make sure you unplug.
So I gave this some thought, and I originally thought it came from my M&A background, whereas you guys know, like M&A attorneys, you either work 100-hour week at a law firm or you have no work. And I was told at that point, take advantage of those like lulls. It is not a long-term marathon. There's just little mini sprints and you got to take the time when you need to take the time. But I actually thought back and realized when I was in high school, my mom may have been the inventor of mental health days. Like if you can imagine, I was an intense kid and every once in a while she'd be like, let's just play hooky. I'm going to take the day off. Let's go chill out. You need to like just do something completely different. So I started that. Yeah, started it, M&A, like obviously you just had to do that to survive. You couldn't work 100 hours a week, every single week. And then once I got in-house, I just recognized, and I think you guys know this, it's not deal flow related. Like there will always be something on fire in front of you, or there'll always be something that you have to do. And I just don't think most people are efficient, are creative, are really coming to the table with good work and good ideas that they're working all the time. And so I just over time, you know, put my foot down and said, I just really do need to take some time to refresh because I'm going to be better and I'm going to have time to make some connections while I'm on vacation. And then the last piece that I think is very important is managers, and it ebbs and flows over time, your vacations and your time off actually enable your team to grow. I'm a huge proponent of I'm going to be out. Like I'm not going to be on Slack. I'm not going to be on email. You've got the bat phone. You can call me, but here's your chance to deal with the CEO while I'm on vacation, or, you know, deal with the most important agreement or big issue that's popping up. And they really have to flex and recognize that they're in charge and they're on the driver's seat.
Make your people that work for you really strong, and then you can shut it down. Like one of the ways I test my team's resiliency is when I'm away, like you guys have met, you know, like people on my team, like when I'm away, I just let them run. And, you know, I make someone who reports to me the escalation point and say, call me if the building's on fire. Other than that, you got this. And I go away. And if I go on away for a week and I come back and everything's on fire, that's not that my team sucks. That's that I'm not leading well. And so I need to make calibrations for my next vacation. So, you know, in a few weeks, I'm going to take a couple days off here and ride my motorcycle where I can't actually access my phone. And I'm confident that Andrew and Denise and the people on my team can just do the job. Make yourself redundant. And I mean, not redundant, but make yourself like, make yourself less critical to everything being turned on and off. And I think you're actually making your team thrive.
And I think, along the way, you're setting up your team for success to do that by like, you know, they don't just like, you know, do some work and hand some information off. They go into the meeting with the CEO and they talk about it with you, and you have the confidence to be like, this person on my team did the lion's share of this work. So like, I have a working knowledge of our strategy and what they did, but like, this is the conversation we're going to have. So like, they have that relationship, they have the trust. And then when you're gone, they take it to the next level, I think.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I was able to leave Triple F and hand things off to my deputy, because she was more than capable and better than me in many, many ways at managing the team and driving things forward.